early than what I did with Daniel Cooper, where I started halfway through the first question. And I'm sure Ben's got some absolute gold to say from the start, so I don't want to miss a thing. Benny, you know how to turn your phone, your mic off mute if you want. I think I might be able to do it for you. Unmute. There we go.
You hear me now?
There we go. That's it.
Yeah, it was fine. Okay, perfect. I was just sitting back and listening, mate. That's all.
I'm sweating up a storm because I've just got off the assault bike.
And
yeah.
Takes a while to cool down from one of those sessions.
Does. I was last night I did one. I finished at 6. And after it, I was still sweating. I had to have another shower.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bradley, who was the team in Wales that you're with?
They were called West Wales Raiders. They were in the League One division.
League One, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it League One, that's just below National Champions 1 or 2?
It's below number 2, so it's okay. Got the Super League Championship and then League One falls just under that.
Okay.
Yeah.
They play against London Scholars and those type of teams?
Yeah, London Scholars is in the same competition. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. What Northern England teams were they play against?
Oh, it's the whole competition is pretty much Northern England. It's
Is it like York? Or are they a championship level?
York moved up to championship because of the whole promotion relegation system.
Yeah.
The other teams were like Workington, Warrington. Warrington, but around those areas.
Workington. What do you think of going to Workington?
Pretty much every place I went and visited up there was quite different, but they all had their unique little things. They all had their own characters and atmospheres.
Yeah, Workington's a bit of a different place up there. Those Cumbria lads are a little bit different.
I couldn't understand anything the referees or the touch judges were saying, that's for sure.
No, they talk with a mouthful of marbles, those blokes.
Have you been over there yourself?
Yeah, I had 3 years. I had a year and a half at Leeds and Wigan. I had 2 years at Widnes Vikings.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you would have heard it all the accents.
Yeah, very good fun.
Yeah.
Across the M62.
Yeah, that's the one.
That's it.
It's quite a diverse competition over there. You can have some really high-end teams and then some...
Yeah.
Like, I'll admit my team, West Wales Raiders, were the lower end of the spectrum, but...
Yeah. Where were they based in?
We were based out of a place called, you're going to laugh when I say it, but Llanelli. It's the Welsh way of saying it. But we kind of trained in Bridgend area.
Yeah, so I know Bridgend. I've been there. Yeah.
Yep. It was, we had a lot of English guys and a lot of imports, Australians, Kiwis. So,
Kiwi Cup, Queensland Cup or New South Wales Cup level players or lower level players that had been over there?
We gained 2 Queensland Cup players, which was good. Most of them were just 1 or 2 divisions below.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah. They were a very new club. They'd only entered that competition, I believe, 2 years ago. And they were really struggling. So they brought over some Aussies to coach and play, which was good.
Yeah, it's good.
Very good. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, as you do.
Yeah.
All righty, guys. All right. Let's start kicking this off. Welcome everyone to another Propel podcast, and hopefully everyone's dialed in and ready to learn and ask questions. If I can ask everyone to please put their mics on mute from now on, except Ben. We just pick up a lot of background noise, and we've had crows and kids and a bunch of other things in the background, and so if we can put the mics on mute, that'd be great. For those who are new to Zoom, there is a chat option. If you've got the app, it's down at the bottom. And there's 2 ways you can ask a question. You can ask either to everyone, in which case I'll mention your name in the question. For example, I'll say Bradley has asked this this question. And then there's another way that you can ask me that question privately, in which case, I won't mention your name. It'll just be, so please do, you've got plenty of options to do that. I'll periodically during the chat with Ben, I'll open it up to the questions and you can do that. And then right at the end, I'll say, hey guys, let's turn the mics off mute and let's actually have a bit of a discussion. If you want to ask Ben or myself any questions, you're more than welcome to do that. Please remember that we've had some very interesting chats so far. We've had Brant Best, an Olympic swimming coach, talk about his preparation for World Champs, Commonwealth Games and the Olympics and what the differences are there. Harrison Westbrook's talked about his high school experience and moving from an athlete into the high school setting and the lessons that he's learned there and what he set up there. And then we've also had Daniel Cooper talk. He moved from the elite military forces in Australia to Super Rugby, high performance team, and he's got a lot of interesting stuff about mindset. So please feel free to jump into that. Over to Ben Cross. Now, Ben, you and I met at a strength and conditioning level 2 a few years ago.
Would have been the end of 2013 when I just arrived back from the UK from playing time over there, I think it was.
Okay, so it was pretty close from there. You're doing your level 2. So from that point, you must have known that you were going to be a coach.
Yeah, a coach in some aspect. I don't know whether it's going to be in strength conditioning or in rugby league itself. I was doing coaching over the UK. So my first coaching started over the UK while I was over there playing. I did a Wigan St Pat teams under 16s and under 18s. And formally, while I was still playing at the Canberra Raiders in 2004, I did my cert 4 in fitness and personal training. So I had that personal training background and obviously football coaching background as well. And then when I returned back to Australia, I thought I did my level 1 S&C when I was in Newcastle Knights in 2010. And then upon returning to Australia, I decided to do my level 2. And then I definitely decided to follow the path of being a football coach.
Yep.
But still having a good grounding and understanding of the strength and conditioning component, which married in really well with being a personal trainer and working as a personal trainer and a rugby league coach and be multiply adaptable in any aspect really with rugby league coaches. Having good grounding of S&C knowledge coupled with rugby league knowledge and coaching, it really helped understand how players adapt and behave under different stresses with their S&C and also the demands of rugby league.
Okay, so we're talking a very early in your career, you had sort of mapped out, as Scott Adams said, maybe not a goal, but you're starting to develop a system that allowed you to, when you retired, you had some options.
Yeah, well, you call it talent stacking, like he's talking about Scott Adams. I was doing it without knowing it was actually a thing at the time.
Yep.
Within that as well, I made sure that I was competent in public speaking, being a personal trainer, an S&C coach, or even going to coaching. You got to be able to present really well and speak in front of a large group really well. So in 2009, coupling with doing a Cert 4 in fitness personal training, I did a Toastmasters course.
Yep.
So it was definitely out of my comfort zone, but you go into a professional realm of rugby league, you get interviewed all the time. Put up on stage to do Q&As, a lot of players should put themselves under the microscope a little bit and make themselves uncomfortable, become comfortable being uncomfortable, and being able to hold a conversation on stage or do a Q&A because you're going to be dealing and talking to a lot of people, so your presentation skills are going to be paramount. So that was another little talent stack that I put in there as well, that I knew what the light at the end of the tunnel was. I just need to know the little stepping stones to get there, and that's still that path is still sort of playing out in front of me now.
All right, so let's talk about this. I wasn't even going to bring up talent stacking, but I mean, it's very clear that you were doing it without knowing the term. So what's your understanding of a talent stack or talent stacking?
Just building on inherent knowledge that you already have and coupling that with knowledge you don't already have in a different field.
Yep.
Whereas a rugby league coach, I need to have good quality communication skills. If a coach doesn't have that, well, then he might be the smartest coaches in the X's and O's going around, but if he can't convey his message, that all goes to waste. Yep. Again, with having a good understanding of S&C background, having that good conversation with your staff, knowing what a player needs and what the collective group needs is something that's multitasking and multi-talented as well. So it's just building on top of yourself to be as, I guess, as horrible as possible in all different facets and giving you a few different sort of ledges to lean on as your expertise.
Yeah, because I would have loved to have known that term, because in my career, I did exactly the opposite of that.
Yeah,
I'm a level 3 strength and conditioning coach. So I did 1, 2, 3. I've done my level 3 in weightlifting. I'm an exercise physiologist. I've done this very, very narrow professional development. And, you know, going to conference, I've been to conferences in New York. And it's, I'm not sure which came first, whether I read Scott Adams' book and then I discovered talent stacking, or I started to feel that I needed to do something outside of my field. But, you know, as some people might know, I've started to learn to code and develop websites and just something totally different out of my field. And I found that it's been phenomenal actually for my coach development, even though most people would look at it and think, you know, what are you doing in that situation? And I bet you there would have been players and maybe even coaches. Why are you going on Tuesday nights or whatever to Toastmasters?
Yeah, definitely. It's, like another thing, like Range by David Epstein's, it's a book I've only just recently read, and you don't know when you're going to hit knowledge bombs until they hit you in the face. So you can do all the study you like in a specific field, but when you start to step back a little bit and start to read about different aspects of things that might not have anything to do with your discipline in S&C or fitness or personal training or in coaching, you can adapt all those different skills to help you in your chosen field. I think previously it always has been everyone just stayed in their lane. So a rugby league coach would stay in their lane, a tennis coach would stay in their lane, the S&C coach would stay in their lane. There's a bit, lot more of integrating at the moment, especially at the higher end level. If you want to be a head coach, whether it's a head S&C coach or a head rugby league coach or a head soccer coach, the more string to your bows that you have and the more understanding, just a general understanding of what everyone else's roles is and how it impacts onto the team and individual, I think holds you in good stead of being a cross-section of all aspects of your sport.
Ben, I 100% agree. One of the things that we've been doing in the last couple of years with the internship is changing our philosophy from stay in your lane to broaden your lane and actually learn more and more about it. And you know, yes, there are a few positions in strength and conditioning or coaching where you only have to look at after one very specific aspect of, you know, whether it's defense, attack, restarts, when it comes to strength, speed, power, you know, you can be a rehab coach.
Yeah.
But except for a very few number of those positions, most of the time you have to be almost everything to your athlete. And so we're actually intentionally trying to broaden our lane to understand nutrition, understand strength, psychology, power. And that's just in the coaching perspective.
Yeah.
In the last couple of years, we've really emphasized the ability to sell, market, and you know, develop other streams of income, understanding the different forms of income. And that's been fascinating, both from my development, but it's based on the philosophy of broaden your lane, don't stay in it.
I don't think anyone expects you to be an out-and-out expert in all those different aspects. If you just have the general understanding of those different sort of parameters around your role, well, then that's suffice. Then if you really need to knuckle down and send someone to go to someone a bit more expertise in that area, well, then that's all well and good. But at least you've got that grounding and sense of a little bit of knowledge about that aspect.
Yep. And it's been also fascinating is, and I'm happy to tell you guys this, is when we started Propel, we tried to do everything ourselves, but eventually we said, hey, let's go look at a marketing company. And not knowing anything about marketing, these guys just, I think they just saw suckers. Like we just walked in and they bamboozled us with all this extra stuff. And we ended up spending 10 grand and we did not get a single client. And the reason I'm telling you this is because I did not know enough to even question them. I knew so little, whereas even if I'd had a little bit of knowledge, I could have gone, wait a second, this is not right. This is not, but we were such novices. And I think, you know, I think that's kind of what you're alluding to there, is if you know enough, like S&C, if I came to you, you've got your level two. If I came to you and I started saying some stuff that was rubbish, you might not be able to argue with me or whatever,
yeah.
but you could pick up that there's something dodgy there or there's something not fitting.
Yeah, no one wants the wool to be pulled over their eyes either. If they're in a fairly high position, and not that it says it happens, but they could have the wool pulled over their eyes sometimes by other coaches or other people in different aspects of a role that, okay, they've just sort of blow it off a little bit and they're not really understand the repercussions of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we can just get back to, let's go back to your NRL career. Arguably one of the toughest leagues in the sport. There's a salary cap. The teams are pretty even. Can you just talk us through I think you played for three teams in the NRL?
Three in the NRL and three in the Super League. So okay. My wardrobe's pretty full, yeah, which is good.
So Canberra to start off with?
Yeah, so I started in Canberra in 2003. I was a bit of a late bloomer. I didn't debut till I was 24.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing in my hometown of Batemans Bay and just grew up through there playing junior football. Then moved to Canberra, played in the local competition there in Canberra. Moved over to France and had a season playing rugby league over in France. And then upon returning at the end of their season, finished the 2002 season in the Canberra competition and got picked up by the Canberra Raiders and sort of went on there for 11 years playing professional.
All right. So who was the first coach? Who was your Canberra coach? Or did you have multiple
Canberra coach was Matthew Elliott at the time.
All right.
Had him for 3 years. And Matthew's a very intelligent person, very intelligent coach. One of his strong points was able to plan and implement a game plan. Not always the most personal type of personal coach that I've played for.
Mm-hmm.
Very articulate of what he wants, and he's a very structured coach as well. Now, a lot of people talk about Melbourne Storm and Craig Bellamy being a very structured, rigid coach.
Which is another coach you played under.
Yeah, I beg to differ. I think Matty Elliott at Canberra there was more structured in regards to how he would play than probably anywhere else I'd played at. Actually.
And as a hit-up forward, did that suit you? Like, to be able to just know your role and implement
it? Did make my job pretty easy. I didn't have to worry about too much. I just got told where to go by the halfbacks, the directors, and head north, young man, and I did my job. Get to this position on the field, then you need to be involved in this play. So as far as that goes, he would call a blue set or a green set, a red set, and you sort of knew how those plays would unfold within that set. So it was fairly regimented and structured at the time.
All right. And then, so you're at the Raiders, then you went to Newcastle?
No, and then Melbourne Storm for 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah, Canberra, then Melbourne. Was at Melbourne for 2006 and 2007.
All right.
Under Craig Bellamy, played in two grand finals and won the premiership in 07.
All right. And so contrasting Craig Bellamy, who's been a head coach for, has he been the Storm's only head coach? Is that right?
No, there was two other before him. Mark Murray and Chris Anderson.
Right, Muppet. All right. And that's like what Melbourne has managed to be able to be dominant for a long period of time. What were some of the differences that you noticed moving from Canberra to Melbourne?
Just the intensity of how they trained. And funnily enough, Craig Bellamy's got a S&C background. He was a strength and conditioning coach for the Brisbane Broncos before he moved in actual football coaching.
Mm-hmm.
So he was always quite a fit player in his own right, and he really valued that in his players. So the intensity of their training was another level, and how competitive it was as well. Everything we ever did at training was a competition.
All right, because give us an example of that.
We would have a wrestling session and you did not want to get beaten.
Okay.
It was almost so. If you got pinned, you had to stay in the ring. If you got pinned, you stay in again. So you only got out of the ring if you pin someone.
Yep.
Competitions on the field. If we had a small-sided game, we would play like it was the grand final. So everything was really structured to be competitive games. And there would be punishments and rewards. And some would be physical punishments. Some would be monetary, where the opposition have to buy you a coffee. Just something that make it fun enough at training to make it competitive that and bragging rights as well. You've got to have bragging rights as well. So,
and in within that competition, was that just made up, you know, like on the spot, like it's you guys against you guys, or were there sub teams?
Fairly planned, or would always be planned. So if it was forwards versus the forwards, or a half a team versus the half a team, say left v right, it would transpire that way. So it'd all be planned and structured in a certain way that we knew what the stakes were as well. But also, we were playing for a very good team, so there's already inherent competition for positions. But what I saw there over the 2 years, there was never any, less of a bit of a backstabbing of teammates to get in front. Yep. We were all actually trying to help each other and push each other forward, because I knew if I was training really hard and the guy beside me was training really hard, we're both getting better.
Yep.
It wasn't that I felt spiteful because someone would take my position, or I was on the bench or anything like that. It was always a really competitive environment, but a very healthy environment. And
so I always wondered about that, because I love competition, setting it up in the gym or in a preseason or something like that. But then I think in a few weeks' time, you guys are going to have to play for each other. And there's, I still default to using the competition as a form of motivation, but I do question it. How did Craig or the staff or the whole team manage that balance of to be able to make everything competitive and yet you were still trying to help the guy next to you?
Because I think that competitive nature amongst you when you're training transpires to the field, because you know the guy wants to beat you first and foremost at training. That means he'll want to beat the opponent out in the field.
Gotcha.
So if he wants to beat you enough in training, once we put on the same jersey together, he'll want to beat that guy in front of him. And so when you've got 13 guys or 17 guys willing to do that for each other, you've got a winning team, you've got a winning culture. Mm-hmm. There's more things that go into just a competitive nature that builds a winning team. There's building trust with each other, and that trust comes from being held accountable and being able to take criticism from your teammates as well. So they're there to improve you, not pull you down.
Yep.
Everyone was always trying to push you up. So they're little things that take time to evolve. And when I got there in 06, Craig had been there from 2003. So he had a bit of time to stamp his authority, his way of doing things. And the players that had been there from 2003, the older players that started the club sort of passed the baton on to the new generation that passed it on. So they were very fortunate when they started in 98. They won the competition in 99. With a very talented, hard-working team, that when the new young guys came in, your Billy Slaters, Cooper Cronks, Cameron Smiths, Maddie Kings, they had a bit of a connection with that foundation players that passed that culture and that baton on. And that's just been happening for the last 20 years now, ultimately because you've got the same coach. So there's always that continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And that cohesiveness and continuity is massive in any successful organisation, let alone sporting team.
Yep.
And then pretty much the last player of that sort of era time now is Cameron Smith. But now Billy Slater, Cooper Cronk, over the last 4 or 5 years have been passing on their culture to those young guys, that once Cameron goes, hopefully they can keep on pushing it forward as well. So just that legacy that the players have been leaving ongoing. And it does help that you've got the same coach for 20 years. All NRL clubs or any sporting organisation would love to have that as well.
Yeah, that stability.
That is.
All right, so 2 years at the Storm, and then you headed over to Newcastle.
Newcastle, yeah. First coach there was Brian Smith. Mm-hmm. Now, Brian Smith is probably one of the most knowledgeable coaches in rugby league there is. Mm-hmm. Can design a game plan, very good at picking apart opposition, very good at working on our strengths against their weaknesses, very analytical. Again, just another one of those coaches that probably just lacked that personal touch.
Yep.
And now all coach development programs that I've ever been part of, or coach education programs, they always go back to building relationships.
Yep.
And he probably wasn't one of those coaches that built a lot of relationships with his players. in saying that, he has a lot of good relationships with a few players that I know that played for him under Parramatta,
mm-hmm.
but not to the extent where you would say like a Wayne Bennett or a Craig Bellamy type of thing. That
because those two coaches that you've just mentioned, Bellamy and Bennett, often the term father figure comes up.
Yeah, yeah.
And they, that, I think they're probably the two longest surviving.
They would be now. They would be. Coaches. And I think that comes back from always building relationships with your players. And you go through any coaching textbook now, any seminar, any coach development program, it's always talking about, comes back to relationships, building trust. You don't have to really love equally all your players, but you definitely have to have a like and rapport of yep. some description, or otherwise it just doesn't make for a healthy working environment.
100%. We often talk about athletes or people first and connect with a person. Yep. And then, so that those three clubs, that was your Australian career.
Yep.
When out of those coaches or where, and those clubs, who did you think, or which club do you think got the best out of you?
Definitely Melbourne Storm.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the first coaches that ever gave me a real clear perspective of what I was really good at as a player.
Yep.
And gave me a simple role and really explained to me how that simple role played in part for the team's success. That if I didn't do my role, our team couldn't have success. Cameron Smith couldn't do his job if I didn't do my role.
Yep.
Billy Slater couldn't do his role if I don't do my role. It was all piecing all those pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together. And we're all told that same conversation when we know we were. But when we all appeased to what he was saying, what our strengths were, it all connected.
Gotcha. So just was, giving you that clarity allowed that you to flourish.
Of what you have to do, that belief of what you had to do, this is why you were doing it. I trust you to do it. That's why you're in my 17. Yeah. Oh. You don't need to second guess yourself. Yeah.
It seems like such a simple thing.
It is. And it's so simple. And again, a lot of things come back to trust. Yeah, at S&C level, personal training level, tennis coach, soccer coach, golf coach. If the athlete doesn't trust the coach,
mm-hmm.
well, then the coach won't trust the athlete. There has to be that trust going both ways. So if a coach is always preaching to the player and the coach is repetitively thinking, I really don't think he can get it. So that means he doesn't trust them.
Yep.
And if that athlete always thinking, I really don't think that coach has my best interest at heart.
Yep.
He's always telling me what to do, not actually asking me what I'm really good at or what I really would like to be doing. There has to be that give and take. And that's where building relationships and rapport is such a strong key element to sports coaching these days.
100%. Now, Benny, so we talked about performance and you felt like you got the best from that, from having that clarity. Tell me a little bit about the strength and conditioning stuff specifically. Was any one season, did you feel better or was it much of a muchness? And once you had the clarity, it didn't really matter what you were doing?
Conditioning wise, for how tumultuous and torturous Melbourne Storm's infamous pre-seasons are, that was the fittest I was ever.
Okay.
For the 2 years there. Not that I wasn't fit at Raiders or Newcastle, I was. But just for some reason, I just felt... And it was a little bit of old school training as well. It was a little bit of, see that hill, we're going to run up it till we can't run up it anymore.
Yeah. So
no GPS, there was no tracking devices, no heart rate monitors. It was virtually till you couldn't go anymore. And that was Craig's way sometimes. You knew that was not only building your physical strength, but it was also building your mental strength.
Yes.
Where a lot of these days, you're monitored. You ran too much today. You haven't ran enough yet. You need to run a little bit faster. Well, this is a down day for you. Where when you get too caught up in the scientific and the collecting of data, you can sometimes miss opportunities, small little windows of opportunities for players or athletes to grow mentally mm-hmm. as well.
All right. So I want to expand on that because now... you've just mentioned it's old school, even though it was 2006, 2007, and now you're in this new era where, as you said, everything's monitored and workload monitoring and GPS and there's apps and heart rate and heart rate variability and all that kind of stuff. How do you balance that? as a coach?
Well, the S&C work that I did at South Newcastle Lions when I was coaching the Newcastle competition, mm-hmm. I had to do it by a bit of touch and feel and trained eye. Mm-hmm. You just have to sort of do it. We didn't have the expertise of having a GPS unit or heart rate monitor. You could sort of track it with a stopwatch that you could see that the players were getting a little bit faster. They were getting their times a little bit easier. So sometimes going back to the old school ways and using your knowledge eye is a good way of developing yourself as a coach.
Yep.
And then if you've got the ability to have the data to back it up as well, and sometimes not look at the data, but trust your gut feel. And if it marries up, well, then you can start to see that you're on the right path as a coach.
Yep.
You're not always just relying on the data because it becomes a bit of a biasist.
Yeah.
So as far as with that, I haven't had to do a lot of S&C work at the professional level or at the semi-professional level, other than preparing my local team in Newcastle mm-hmm. through a trained professional eye and using data of meters per second and MAS data that I use at Newcastle.
Mm-hmm. So we've got a question from Bradley. Do you know what your best Bronco test time is? Bradley, is that the 20, 40, 60? Repeat 5 times. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, the old Bronco test, yeah.
Yeah.
It would be, funnily enough, the man's 120 kilos and he's 6'4". It's Payne Haas, and I think he did it in 4:57.
So that was, but what was your time?
My time? I've never done it.
Oh, you've never done it?
No. No, I haven't done the Broncos test. No.
Okay.
I can't remember.
Do you remember any numbers from the gym or what's your PB in the squat? Or?
Oh, beat test. I think we used to do 16, might have been on the beat test.
16?
Is that pretty good? I think that was, yeah.
That's very good.
Beat test, yeah. I was come up a go as with Kirk Gidley. I don't know if you remember Kirk Gidley.
Yes, fullback.
Captain at the fullback, yeah, at Newcastle. He was up around the 19s, 20, 21s consistently. Like, he was an absolute freak. Billy Slater was the same. He was always up around there. Wow. But I think about 16 for myself. And, yeah.
That's big numbers. Just going back to the building your coaching eye, it's one of my concerns that I do worry for a young coach who maybe gets, you know, could work for the Broncos or as a sports scientist and gets exposed to all the gadgets, not the gimmicks, the gadgets, where that, and that's what they rely on. And I kind of feel like, hey, go back to club footy, or park footy, let's call it that, and learn to be able to read what players are doing and kind of develop those skills. And then when you add the tool, the GPS, the app, whatever, then that's made you an infinitely better coach.
Yeah.
But if you rely on that too early and you don't develop that, and that comes from your personal training, coaching young athletes, amateurs. I worry about that.
That technology would just back up your inherent knowledge that you've gained through university or your online studies or whatever studies you're doing. We see a lot of guys that come straight out of university and do an internship with the Broncos or any other professional organization. So they're coming from a highly educated environment as it is university. Mm-hmm. So they've got all the bells and whistles and the gadgets there. Then they're going to another environment where they've got all the gadgets and the technology. They don't have any of that grounding of getting back to the substance of having to use your gained knowledge at the rawest sense.
Yep.
Because then they do get the biases of having to rely on the numbers and what the machine said and what the data says. Sometimes that data doesn't always correspond and correlate to actually how the athlete is feeling.
Yep.
And that's one of the big questions that a lot of that data cannot answer. It cannot answer how the athlete is actually feeling. And we've seen it that the athletes will come in and do a pre-screening before they go out and training. It's just a bit of a tactic feel, how they actually feel. They feel terrific and they would tick the box that I'm feeling terrific today. I had 9 hours sleep, and they'll go and train out in the field and their data will be terrible. And it'll be on the flip side as well. They said, I had no sleep last night. The baby was up all night. I feel really tired and sluggish. they'll go out and train the house down.
Yep.
So sometimes a lot of that data doesn't correlate to what's actually going on. Not to dismiss it, but use it to support what you see as well.
Yeah, and there's another thing that also interests me. It's just it's more of a thought experiment. Is if we constantly adapting the workload that we are going to give the athlete based on that data, how do we train them to not care how they feel, but the thing that we always have propelled, no one cares how you feel, only what you do. Yeah. And on game day, you could have had a bad night's sleep. If you've been pampered and you know, everyone's running around you and saying, okay, decrease workload or whatever. I just worry that you're not going to be prepared for that, where things haven't gone right and you still have to prepare regardless.
Well, I think that's that knife edge that everyone's always going to sit on, where you're preparing the athlete for the worst case scenario. And that's what we were doing at the Broncos. We're always trying to prepare the players for the worst case scenario. Okay. Always try to train above game speed. Everything was done quite fast, quite intense. But then again, we can't do it all the time, because then we're teetering on injuring the player as well.
Yep.
So you may break a couple of people, and they may come back a little bit stronger, but it's that knife edge that's balanced out. And I don't know if there's any S&C coach or any sort of program in the world that has got that 100% right. And I don't think they'll ever will be, because just human beings are just too varied from day to day, and the variability of how we are, how we perform.
Yep, 100%. All right, so Ben, so you've been in three Australian clubs, then you decided to head over to the UK, and you were at three clubs in the UK. Could you sum up any sort of differences between the two countries in the preparation and coaching? Were there any glaring differences? Yeah,
there's one massive difference in preparation. They prepare in the winter months, so pre-season's freezing cold compared to Australia.
Gotcha.
Their season's in the summer, so that's one thing. Just the intensity of the competition over there is not quite as hard as the NRL. They just don't have the quality of depth. So every game is not televised as well. So
okay.
It still already feels like it just drops down a level. You're going and playing in front of a very vocal crowd. Might only be 3,000 or 4,000 people at some grounds, but very vocal. But if the TV cameras aren't there, not that you totally notice as a player, but you do know.
Yep.
Where every game in the NRL is a big deal.
Yes.
Cameras, lights, action. And the quality, just the sheer quality of competition is superior. And that's no fault of anyone's, other than probably just the lack of a little bit of development in the UK with their rugby league program, and in France to a degree. But again, soccer's their national sport over there. And
yep, sure.
Rugby league's only really played in the northern part of the UK, and then rugby union down the southern end. So very working class. So you're still trying to capture a small market of athletes over there, and soccer's very dominant. So
And so at the back end of that, people are starting to ask you to be player coach. What is that like, balancing playing with your athlete, playing with the guys, but then I don't know, have to coach? Did you select them?
Well, yeah, I didn't coach with the team that I was playing with. So I was playing with the Widnes Vikings for the last 2 years, and I was coaching at under 16s and under 18s.
Oh, gotcha.
Wigan. Yep. I was still living in Wigan after I played there and stayed there. So that was a terrific opportunity to just get back to grassroots rugby league and coach at the amateur level. And thankfully, a few of those players have actually gone on to be professional rugby league players with the Wigan Warriors now.
Awesome.
Great, yeah.
Okay. Now, tell us about those first few years of actual coaching when you've got this under 16 or this under 18 team.
Yeah.
What were some of the lessons there where, you know, you might have as a player thought, I'll never do this as a coach, or every coach should do this, but then when you're in front of their players, maybe it doesn't go as according to plan?
Yeah, it was probably a bit too drill-based at the time, and set on trying to develop core skills at an under-16s and under-18 levels instead of developing their playing skills. So it sounds a little bit of a contradiction where we would do block practices or very small drills to focus mm-hmm. on a specific skill, instead of playing small-sided games so they can practice the skill in the context.
Yep.
Not that we didn't do it, but we probably focused too much on skill development as a silo
mm-hmm.
instead of skill development in the context of actually playing small-sided games. So that was something that took me a little bit of time to develop and really penny to drop, that more skill-based games and teaching for understanding is what should be done for young athletes, especially at that age group.
Yep. Yeah, and to be fair, Bennett, it's almost refreshing to hear you make or hear a coach make those mistakes. While I'm not saying an under-16's career isn't important, I suppose I'm just trying to say that it's the consequences are a lot lower, that if you don't get that right, you can reflect and develop and then make changes from the 16s to the 18s and then build it. And there's a lot of players or former players who want to rush to that process.
There is. There's a lot of players that will go straight from playing straight into coaching and coach that level, whether it be amateur rugby league or under 16s or 18s, as if they were coaching an NRL team.
Yep.
And you've got to know the environment you're in. You've got to know the audience that are in front of you, because it's all retrospective to where they are. You don't teach a kindergarten student the same as you would a student in year 12.
Yep.
And that's what I'm seeing a little bit at the amateur level in junior rugby league.
Yep.
That a lot of dad coaches doing their best putting their hand up is what they're called Friday night footy coaches.
Yep.
They're coaching what they see on Friday night footy and trying to do it with their kids level. So that was something that I sort of learned. Not that I took that sort of aspect of being a Friday night footy coach with the under 16s and 18s team that I was doing. I was trying to implement too much of what I did at the professional level on guys that just weren't at that level at a 16s and 18 year old.
Yep.
And we started to realize that as well. And said, you know, they're better off just playing games in small sort of games and use a bit of implicit learning. And then every now and then we'll do a little bit of explicit learning. So with tackle technique and passing technique, but ultimately a lot of it was implicit learning.
Yeah. It's interesting because, I mean, I know from my own development in the early days, seeing what probably you guys were doing in the NRL and then kind of bring it down to a high school setting or with junior athletes. And I was so focused on getting to where I wanted to get to that I kind of forgot about who I was coaching and what they needed. It was more about what I knew or what I implemented. And one of the biggest things I remember in 2005, I ordered a bunch of bands, resistance bands, and we did squats with bands and stuff. And thankfully no one got injured. Those athletes didn't need bands, but they benched and squatted with it. And, you know, I was giving them what I had been reading and watching, not what they needed to get stronger.
Yeah. And it's important for the listeners that are listening here tonight that I might be talking about rugby league in the coaching aspect of rugby league, but it's all the same principle for any coaching, whether it's S&C or personal training or whatever. Coach to the audience that's in front of you, not to the audience that you want to be coaching in front of.
Yeah.
That's a massive key takeaway and something I've learned along the way as well. That if you might be an S&C coach and you're coaching someone how to do the snatch, or there's modified versions of the snatch for 12-year-olds, 16-year-olds and 18-year-olds.
Yep.
Or they can do a full snatch, and same with a clean and jerk or a power clean as well. So regress it and progress it with the audience that are in front of you.
Yeah. I think that's one of the clear things from an experienced coach, and I'm talking S&C or sports coaches, they don't necessarily have a whole bag of different drills, but their drills can be regressed and progressed to whatever is in front of them. And so, you know, if I think that's so much more important. But, you know, through this, you know, especially with Instagram and social media, where you can see all these new exercises, everyone's trying to grab the next exercise that looks fancy and looks fun. Yeah. And, but it's just maybe a little bit of a regression here and a progression here that probably sets the better coaches apart.
Yeah. I was only just talking to a friend today, about when I used to do a bit of carpentry work. And so it was just me and my boss, and we'd build a two-story house. We'd get the first story done, then we'd do the floor, and then it was my job to get the second-story frames up.
Yep.
So I'd have to get in a squat position and do a squat thrust and push the frame up. So I was inherently doing a squat press without even knowing it and putting myself in that sort of situation. So when you can start to associate it with real-life activities, things that you want to get your clients to do or your athletes to do, and use analogies as well like that, that allows them to understand it a little bit better sometimes too, from an S&C point of view or a personal training point of view or any type of coaching point of view as well.
Yep. And that comes back to Nick Winkelmann's research about, you know, the cueing and stuff, jump like a frog or explode like a rocket. It's way better than triple extension or something like that, if you can make it connect with the athlete. So Ben, okay, so we finish up in the UK, you come back to Newcastle. And you start, you did some laboring work, but you were looking for coaching work pretty much from the beginning, weren't you?
Yeah, well, while I was over in the UK, I phoned up Rick Stone, who I played under at Newcastle. He was with the coaching staff at Newcastle Knights there, coaching the reserve red side. And I said, are we interested in the coaching? And knew I'd been coaching over in the UK and knew that I knew what I was doing. I had all my coaching certificates. So when I came back, I was assistant coach of the Newcastle Knights New South Wales Cup team for 2 years.
So the feeder team.
The feeder team, the reserve red side, which was good being directly underneath. So Newcastle had their first red side and had a direct reserve red side. So we would get NRL players come back and play reserve red with us as well. So I was coaching current first graders at that time as well, which was a good foot in the door.
Yep. And but then you also started picking up some other gigs. One was your son's coaching gig.
Yeah, so I coached under sixes, and then as you progress, under sixes, under sevens there. And also, so from a period of time from 2014 through to 2018, before I left to come to the Broncos, I coached my son's sixes, sevens and eights. Mm-hmm. I was doing personal training. I was doing rugby league coaching at Hunter Sports High School in Newcastle, where they have from year 7 to year 12 rugby league program. So I was coaching across all those age groups. I coached, after my time at Newcastle, I went and coached a local team, the Newcastle competition, South Newcastle Lions at their first grade level. And that's a quite a high level of rugby league for Newcastle.
So that's a level, so
just below.
Just below. So that's a regional competition, not a state competition.
Yeah. So you've got the state competition with New South Wales Cup, and then you've got Newcastle local competition just below that. And that had quite a few New South Wales Cup quality players playing in it and former NRL players playing in it. And then coaching the New South Wales women's state of origin team for 3 years as well.
Now, for me, I get really excited about that resume. I reckon you would have picked up lessons from learning to deal with 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds. I reckon you would have got lessons from picking up from the woman, from dropping down a level, which might, for many people, you know, might be an ego thing. But can you tell us some of the lessons that you learned from each of those stages? Because I think everyone's pushing so hard to get up and be, you know, on the TV with the professionals, with the elite guys. But they don't actually have that time to really develop their ideas, find their own coaching. Can you expand on that?
Regressing my career was a springboard actually to go forward faster. And it led so much more to my development than some players go directly from playing directly straight into professional coaching. And they've got all the resources in the world and the club has done everything for them. They just have to turn up and coach.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Going from a professional environment, I'm glad I went from a professional playing environment to just the tier below the NRL coaching and New South Wales Cup, because it wasn't too unprofessional, but it wasn't at the amateur level in Newcastle. So I still had a bit of a feel for, we would have players that played in the Newcastle local competition progress up and come and play for us at the Newcastle Knights level. So I got to see the quality of those players, but also as had interaction with NRL players coming back a level as well.
Yep.
I think if I had have gone straight from professional playing to coaching an amateur rugby league team, I would have been way too much for them. And my standards and my expectations would have been way too high, and I think I would have been way too frustrated.
Yep.
So having that step back level of New South Wales Cup, where they're good players, but they're not all of them at NRL level.
Yes.
Some of them are amateur level.
Yeah.
Then going coaching at the amateur level, I take bits and pieces of what I knew would work at the NRL level, what I could see worked at the New South Wales Cup level, and regress that back to the amateur level in the Newcastle competition. We had a lot of high quality players there as well. A lot of those players had aspirations to go and play in NRL as well. So I made sure that I coached at a level that it was to complement them as well. So it was enough to push the aspiring players to get to the NRL, and it was just enough reach for the players that just wanted to play local league but were still a good player, that it wasn't too overreaching for them. I think that's what probably helped me down the track as well with coaching. So I went straight from South Newcastle Lions in an amateur competition straight to the Brisbane Broncos in the NRL.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, I just want to stop there. So I'd never considered that, like actually taking a few steps to get down to the level, because I've always thought a former player should, you know, almost start at the bottom.
Yeah. But
that would be wrong, wouldn't it? There'd be too much of a disconnect. They would really struggle in that situation.
Yeah, taking a former professional player and putting him straight to an under-16s or an under-18s team. Can be quite difficult at times as well, because their expectations would not match up with the players of the ability that are in front of them.
Yes.
And I was very fortunate to be coaching at a Hunter Sports High, where I was coaching any kids from 12 to 18 years old. That some were very talented, some not so talented. We had a broad spectrum of talent and age. So there wasn't an age group or talent spectrum that I hadn't coached. And then a lot of the lessons that I learned coaching in under sixes, under sevens and under eights with my son's team carried over to senior footy. A lot of patience, clear explanation of the drill. So,
and that comes back to the communication that we were talking about earlier.
And the more and more reading, the more education I do in rugby league, that if you can't explain something to a six-year-old, well, then stop.
Yes.
Because if you're trying to be too technical and too in-depth your explanation about your drill or what you're trying to do to a professional athlete, guess what? There's a fair chance it'll go straight over his head as well. Because he's either under fatigue or he's got other stuff to worry about. He needs simple, direct instructions, either implicitly or explicitly. And that's what I took from under coaching under sixes.
Yes.
And then going and coaching women, that's a whole nother ballgame.
Okay. Let's explore that. Because on social media, I put something that it's different. And
it is.
I got absolutely hammered by, I think it was like the UK rowing fraternity. There were people just jumping on and dunking on me. And to me, I think there's differences between elite and junior or development. There's a differences between professional and amateur. I think there are differences between sports. And I'm saying, hey, guys, there's differences between male and female.
There is.
And I got cleaned up. But anyway, tell me some of the differences you noticed.
One thing, a little bit of feedback that I got from a few of the players that had been involved with the program.
Because you were there 3 years, weren't you?
I was there for 3 years, And unfortunately, they'd never won a game, in 17 years. And then 19 years of the competition had been running between New South Wales and Queensland. And sort of players said that it was the first time they ever got explained to why they had to do something or why what they did helped their teammate and the outcomes that it would happen. And that was something a little bit that I took from Craig Bellamy in my coaching, that why you do this has a massive outcome, and how all their roles interplay with each other. And if you can do this, that helps that player. And if you do that, that helps that player. Mm-hmm. Or there's a specific reason why I want you to get to that position in the field, because it gives a 6-4 split or a 5-5 split. And a few of the players realized the penny started to drop for them and said, okay, we've never been explained to the why of we're doing something. We're always just being told what to do, because some of the coaches might have thought they just didn't know what they were doing enough. They had the skills enough to catch and pass a footy and make a tackle and play the ball and kick, but didn't have the grasping the understandings of how to play the game.
Yeah. And that kind of comes back to working with six-year-olds. So make it simple enough for that. But also, kind of what you just said there is that there are players who are physical, or they fit, or they can take a hit, or they can make a hit. But that doesn't mean they understand the game. And I sometimes think, well, looking at your career and then looking at how you've coached, we need to get back to basics, because we go to these coach development seminars and workshops and stuff, and our knowledge is increasing, but it's not necessarily being disseminated to all the players.
Yeah, and how players learn as well. So like a few of those girls that I'd coached at New South Wales, they played a lot of touch footy and Oztag type of game, but never played structured competitive rugby league. But they had all the skills and attributes to do it. Mm-hmm. They didn't know why they had to do this or what they had to do. So they could play the game without knowing why they do what they do to play the game.
Yes.
So once I got that over the line, and it really helped having some quality players in there that could pick up it pretty quick, and they could then learn off each other. So that's the best way to summer in any sport, whether it be weightlifting, running track, tennis, cricket, golf. Players learn from their peers probably sometimes better than they learn off their coaches.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they get different multiple learning portals where they're getting off their coach and they can actually see their teammate do it, and they're getting instruction from their teammate, you've got a good learning environment.
Yeah, 100%. Now, just while we're on that, Brad's just asked a question. In regards to females in rugby league, what do you find the biggest cultural differences compared to males?
Just the amount of questions.
Females questions, ask more questions?
Questions, questions, questions. As I said, alluded to before, just the whys. They want to know why for everything.
Yeah.
And
if you know, if you don't accept that or appreciate that, where they just they want to understand it at maybe a deeper level, then there's going to be some kind of friction or frustration on both sides.
And you as a coach better know, because just because doesn't float.
No,
just because I want you to do it. Well, then if a coach says that to a female athlete, just because I want you to do it, they won't do it. Because you got to remember, with the female athlete, it's in their inherent DNA to be giving. Their mothers, their grandmothers, their nurses, a lot of the roles that they do in actual life are they're givers.
Yep.
So if they're given a real good purpose to do something, they give their all.
Yep.
They're very selfless as athletes and as people.
I've actually found when we've talked about this on previous podcasts, is I actually feel that I prefer coaching with female athletes. Because I think that the buy-in is greater. I think the mental toughness is actually higher. And I think the rewards are better in those circumstances. I give the example when I've left an academy once, I'm still have relationships with those female athletes. They'll text me, or I get a happy birthday, or something will remind them or whatever. The males, they just moved on. Like, they did not care that I'd left. Like, the new guy was there, and that's awesome. And I was the new guy at one stage, and they didn't care about the previous guy there. Whereas the females...
That's just a bit of our nature as men, and a little bit of nature as females. It really is.
Yep. Now, we've got a question from Charles. We're circling back, but what do you think is stopping other clubs from emulating the Storm culture? It's clearly a winning recipe, but it doesn't seem to be something that can be used elsewhere. Is it purely down to special people like Bellamy and Bellamy, and how deeply ingrained the culture is? What is it that stops a club from building a Crusaders in rugby union, Storm, Saracens type culture?
Roosters are doing a little bit at the moment as well. And if you have a look at their side and the team, even going back as far as probably not 2010 when they lost the grand final, but they won a grand final in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, they've won the last two grand finals. They've got quite a few of the players that are still the same. Mm-hmm. And talk about that connection, cohesive building. You just got to have that cohesiveness. And that culture builds, and it's almost like the 18th man, that culture, and clubs like the Roosters and Melbourne Storm, and even Manly had it for a while Des Hasler was there as well, that you've got that continuity and you've got that stabilityness of, the first one is the head coach. It's the same head coach.
Mm-hmm.
He can have that impact on all those players over a sustained period of time.
Yep.
So the clubs are always going to get talented players. There's a lot of talented rugby league players out there, and it's not always about how much talent that they can recruit, but it's what they can do with their talent within that organisation. So as I was saying before, he gave his players quite a clear, specific role to do, gave them a value on that. If you can do that, you hold your position because this is so valuable to the team. You need to have a couple of X-factor quality players as well, which Storm have had over the years, so has Manly, so has the Roosters. But if you have a look at the clubs that haven't had a lot of long-term success, you probably can't count the number of head coaches they've had on one hand in the last 10 years.
Yep.
They go through the head coach. And for a coach to have a real deep impact, he has to be there for at least 5 years. You can't 5 years. Throw... It would be 5 years because he's inheriting a roster that he didn't select. He's inheriting a training program that the players are used to that he hasn't selected yet. So that takes time. Players have to adapt, whether it be their S&C program, how they train, how they play. All that has to take time. And that would nearly take 2 to 3 years. So then you're only starting to see the fruits of your labor year 4 and year 5. And then you started to recruit your own players that you deliberately want at the club.
Mm-hmm.
So clubs that don't have a lot of success, they usually have a high turnover of the head coach.
Yep.
And unfortunately, the coach can coach. And he might be really, really successful coach if he was allowed to stay there for the long term. Just like all generations now at this age, they want immediate satisfaction and immediate return on their investment, where Melbourne didn't get immediate return on their investment, Craig Bellamy. They won their first premiership under Craig in 07. Mm-hmm. Then they went on a run.
Yeah.
Same with Manly with Des Hasler when they had their little purple patch. Same with Trent Robinson with the Roosters. It's only now he's won three minor premierships and two premierships off the back of when Brian Smith, or three premierships and three minor premierships after Brian Smith sort of led them to that success as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes time. It's connections, cohesiveness, and building relationships. And those big clubs that have sustained success, they become like a family.
Yep.
No different to the Broncos throughout the early 90s through to the 2006, really, that purple patch that they had. A lot of the players are all the same, and you know the head coach was the same. So there's that stability.
Yeah. It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because there's the stability and then there's the pressure. And we often think that when the coach is changing a lot, you know, like you said, if you can count on one hand in 10 years,
yeah,
you've really got to start looking higher than the coach, don't you? It's the board, the CEOs, all those people that are probably making unreasonable demands. There's a book, and it's just escaped me. It's something like the 7... Habits of Great Groups. It's not the highly successful ones. It's about groups. And one thing that they picked up, and they looked at a bunch of different groups, including the group that built the H-bomb, Walt Disney, or Disneyland or Disney. There were 7 of these groups. And they said that every group had, and they called it the bulldog. And what the bulldog did is protected, in this case, the coach from the people who are talking about wins and losses and finances and all that kind of stuff. And if you don't have that bulldog, then the pressure from the board to the CEO to the head coach is just totally transferred. But if someone can protect the coach and give them that buy-in time and allow them to develop, that's something successful. But most people just take the pressure that they're feeling and put it onto the person below them.
Yeah, and that's where the hierarchy have to have faith in the man that they put in charge.
Yeah.
And in saying that as well, Dave Whedon, who's a coach development guy down in Melbourne, he's got the Next Coach program down there with AFL. He made a really good statement in a course that I did with him not too long ago. Is you should feel comfortable at your club.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ever feel complacent. So he always used to be talking about in professional sports, oh, he started to feel comfortable, That's a little bit of a load of crap. You should feel comfortable.
Yeah.
You should feel comfortable in your skin. You should feel comfortable in your environment that you're working and training in. That doesn't mean you're complacent. It goes, are you comfortable in the home you're living in? I said, well, if you are, and you answer yes, does that mean you should move out? So it's like talking to an athlete, oh, as soon as you just start to feel comfortable, you should move on. That's not the case. It's you should feel comfortable. You should feel comfortable in having good rapport with your teammates and good rapport with your coach. But it's the other C word, that complacency, that leads a lot of those clubs and athletes astray.
Yeah, and differentiating that. I've never heard that. That's interesting. Yeah. So differentiating between comfort and complacency.
Yeah.
I'm writing that one down, Ben.
It's a good one. You know your stuff, Dave.
I've got another question from Mitch. When coming to a new club, was there something that stood out that the coaches did to build trust amongst new players? Or was there a level of trust in the coach when arriving at the new club?
You always have a little bit of a level of trust with the coach when you get there because he's recruited you there. So there's obviously something that he's seen in you that he likes and he can trust. So there's already that little bit of rapport and that trust with the coach as it is. As far as it goes with the players, we've introduced it at the Brisbane Broncos. Melbourne Storm did it. That have even clubs, nearly all clubs have been to, they have a bit of a truth Q&A question and answer time where it was almost a little bit of stand up in front of everyone. It was a bit of a firing line and they're allowed to give you two or three good things or qualities that they've seen you view as a player, especially if you're a new player at the club, but they would do it to everyone. And then two or three qualities that they see in you as a player that's not quite good.
Oh, wow.
And they'd usually
pretty confronting.
They would. And the first time I was exposed to it was in Melbourne in 2005 pre-season leading into the 2006 season. And I'd come from a new club. So players had only seen me play 24 or 25 NRL games or maybe not even seen me play NRL at all or knew much about me. So it would be after a month of pre-season training, they would stand you up in front of the room and the guys, the senior player groups, or anyone had something to say would say about you, Crossy, you're a really great trainer. On the field, you probably give away too many penalties at times and you fly off the handle. So they would pick you apart a little bit, but it was always to make you better, to realise this is what we see of you in our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be sometimes strengths that you wouldn't realise that they would see in you and go, oh, I didn't even know you thought of me like that.
Mm-hmm.
Good and bad. Not all players could handle it. And it was so a
what,
sort of,
would that break down or?
They would. They would take everything pretty fairly personal. Mm-hmm. But again, it was like that. We're critiquing the athlete in front of us, what we're seeing on the training paddock and what we're seeing on the TV. Mm-hmm. We're not critiquing the person we know or don't know.
Yep, gotcha.
So that's a lot of guys that can't differentiate between that. And in being a coach, S&C coach, personal trainer, or any level of coach, you'll see that with your athletes sometimes. They'll think you are coaching the person, but you're critiquing the athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they need to be a reminder of that. And sometimes coaches need to be reminded of that as well, that they critique the person and not their athletic performance.
Yeah, good point. Ben, there's another question that I just want to go back to. So you said how the coaching a under 6, 7, and 8-year-old team and how coaching women have maybe helped you with your career. You also did quite a bit of personal training. Have you been able to carry over anything that you learned from there into your coaching?
Well, and personal training was a perfect segue or leg up into rugby league coaching, because the first word, personal. You have to get personal with your clients. It's not even about what you're doing with the training. It's about being personal with the person in front of you. So appeasing to their needs, their goals, their aspirations, and getting to know that person. So that was a really good insight into connecting with people and building relationships with your personal training clients. And mm-hmm. that was a good learning point to bring it into coaching as well, is that you have to get personal with your players. You don't have to invite them all around for dinner or have a beer with them. You're going to have that relationship with everyone. There's 6 billion people in the world. So, mm-hmm. but you've got to find that some sort of personal connection on some level. I didn't connect personally outstandingly with all my personal training clients, mm-hmm. but enough that we would be amicable towards each other and friendly enough, and a lot of my personal training clients are now become friends, and I don't train them anymore. Some personal training clients, they were there for a business exchange. I give you money, you train me, I go home, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And some players or some of your athletes are going to be like that as well.
Yep.
But that's the relationship you're having with them. That relationship is sometimes even stipulated early in the piece, and by mutual consent, or the client does that. And that's sometimes a way that you can take that learning as well, that you're going to have some players that there's not going to be such a big connection with, but you just need that one little one that I'm not always going to talk about what you did over the weekend, over a couple of beers when there's opportunity to do that. But just finding one little interest that you both share, just to have that little bit of connection.
I'm glad you said that, because for some reason, and I've been through this myself as a strength and conditioning coach, maybe because I've got a degree and a postgrad, I've looked down on personal trainers. Sometimes I think it's justified. You see some really horrific stuff in a commercial gym of squatting on Swiss balls and doing all that kind of stuff. But that could be anywhere, really. But there's this egotistical sort of looking down upon PTs from the S&C world that, one, I don't think should be there. I think it hones your skills. It allows you, you have to provide, it allows you to develop all those soft skills that you've probably been, talking around or about. I think of providing the energy. So 5 a.m, I don't want to be there. I'd rather be in bed or something, but no one cares how I feel. It's what I do.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of things that you can only learn by practicing them. And the only place, well, probably the best place that a strength and conditioning coach could learn it is with personal training.
Yeah, you learn to have to be the motivator. Where a lot of times being an S&C coach, your athletes are coming to you and they're fairly motivated. They've got a meet coming up, a swim meet or athletics carnival or Olympic Games or Commonwealth Games coming up. They're fairly motivated to turn up. A lot of the personal training clients, you're their motivation.
Yep.
You're the reason why they got out of bed to come and see you at 5 o'clock in the morning. Not only because they paid you the money, but you're holding them accountable to it. And then you have to pick them up, push them forward. That sounds a lot like sports coaching. Sounds a lot like strength and conditioning coaching, being able to one to push them forward and see within them what they don't see within themselves.
Yep.
So you can do this. I've seen you do this before and give them that belief where sometimes it is a little bit of smoke and mirrors, and you got to be a bit more theatrical at the time and borderline lying. But sometimes you have to make stuff up to get the desired result.
Yep. I've got a question from Luke. As a rugby coach, how would you describe your relationship with your S&C coach in any environment and your expectations of them?
Well, when I was coaching at South Newcastle Lions, it was tremendous because I was both.
Yes.
But sometimes it was conflicting because I wanted the guys to get fitter and faster, so I'd have to take away time from the S&C and focus on the footy.
Yep.
So, but no, always good, always good. I always had a lot of time with my S&C coaches, even while I was a player.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Rogers, he was the S&C coach.
Newcastle?
Newcastle, yeah. So yes. We're still good friends because I wanted to know how I could get better in all aspects. So I always had good relationships with my forwards coach or coach specifically looking after my area on the playing field, but always make sure that if I can be a better athlete, I'll be a better footy player. So I always had quite a good, strong connection with my S&C coaches, and S&C coaches at the Brisbane Broncos always go down onto the gym floor, see how the players are going. It's good to have that connection, and players like seeing the sports coaches down on the gym floor to see how they're going. Like your squats 220, that's going to help you break tackles.
Yep.
Your shoulder pressing XYZ, that's going to help you push defenders off. So having that little connection, so mate, what you're doing in the gym is tremendous, because mate, we're the fastest play the ball in the comp, and we're the most tackle breaks in the comp. Something you're doing in the boys down the gym must be really working.
Yep.
Yeah.
So and sorry, just going back and kind of expanding on Luke's question, did you find your level two, it obviously helped when you're South Newcastle, but now does it help having your strength and conditioning?
It does. It just gives you a bit more of that insight into why they're strategically planning the way they're planning. You sort of know the phases they're going through in pre-season and how it's sort of correlating to what we're doing on the field. Mm-hmm. So as we get closer to playing games like you were at the back in the pre-season, obviously the amount of conditioning or isolated conditioning work would drop off, and we'd be doing more skill games. So you'd understand that was becoming, and you could sort of see the players were getting faster, the players were getting fitter, and that was a lot of the work that we were doing with our skill games, but also what the conditioning coaches were doing as well.
Yep. So Ben, if we had to ask you, what would you tell a young Ben Cross, the athlete? So as a mature athlete, you've learned things, and then you've learned a whole bunch of more stuff as a coach. If you had to say to that 23, 24-year-old who's just about to debut in the NRL or whatever age you want to choose, what would you be saying to that young athlete?
A couple little points I wrote down was probably just there's no need to doubt the athlete. So the young athlete, you always sort of second guess whether you're quite good enough. Do I belong here? If you put the work in, just let your performance do the talking for you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't put the work in previously, well, then your performance will tell you.
Yep.
So you only need to compare yourself with the player you were last week, or you only need to compare yourself with the player you were yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then you'd sort of get caught up in, oh, geez, this player ran for X amount of meters and I only ran for that type of meters. But then you wouldn't really understand the finer details that his team had 57% of the ball and your team only had 45% of the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not comparing apples to apples. So you only really need to compare yourself to yourself. And if you're putting the work in, trust your actions, they're going to be all right on the field. So that was one of them. And sort of another one would be just quality over quantity. I was a massive closet trainer. I would, when I was at Canberra Raiders, I deliberately lived within 5 km of the training facility. So with my roommate, Marshall Chalk, he was a player at the time as well. And because I didn't debut till I was 24, I just felt like I always had to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
Always just trying to catch up. I didn't get any of the development of the under-18s or reserve grade that a lot of those other guys got. So I would run to training, do the work there, then get a lift home with my teammate. Mm-hmm. Or I would go to training, do the work, and then run home. Or I would put my bike in his ute and I'd run to training, do all the work all day, and then ride my bike home. So I just did a lot of overtraining, did too much, and it even carried forward to when I was living in Melbourne. We live within 5 km of the training facility. Mm-hmm. I would do it there as well, and I found out pretty quickly you don't do that at Melbourne because you can't walk home. Their pre-seasons are that hard. And it had to sort of stop after a while, so I started doing the runs at the end of training instead of beforehand. But I'd run 5 km to training, then do a full day's NRL training, and then go home after that. So I started to realize if you need to do a bit of a top up, do it at the end of the session. But yeah, I did too much quantity instead of probably enough positional specific training for myself. So being a middle forward, up and back shuttles, MAS type of stuff, I did too many long distance runs, which really isn't conducive to my position. But at the time, I just thought more was better.
Yep. And that's typical of a young coach. It's typical of a young player. to focus on that. And then now, this is, what is this? Is this your sixth or seventh year of coaching? What? How many years have you, from those?
Yeah, probably around the 16. Yeah, probably six or seven, something like that, yeah.
You've talked about what you learned in that under 16 year where you were wanting to go more implicit and you'd go more game-based and stuff. Anything else that you would tell that coach 7 years ago?
Probably, I don't think I would have really changed too much. Very much of the age bracket that I was coaching initially, I really want to develop their core skills and fundamentals of the game. But as I said before, I'd probably go back and using a bit more of teaching games for understanding and not as much blocked drill practice.
Yep.
And be able to marry the two up a little bit more. So if you're doing a specific skill, then quickly go into a game that's specific to that skill as well.
Yep.
So you've got the best of both worlds. Yeah, that was probably the only thing. And I was never one to really be overawed about the halo effect of someone's talent. I've always been right about effort.
Yes.
And that's something that's is always stick with me, that I'd always go for someone's effort over talent. And that was something that I picked up from a young age as a coach.
Okay. Awesome. Now, team, we're going to, if you want to unmute your mics, feel free to type in a question for Ben. But if you want to unmute your mics, this will be a good time to do so. Feel free to ask him a question, ideally about his coaching career, but feel free to ask about the playing stuff too. And we'll give it a few seconds just to see if anyone's got anything. Bradley's unmuted his mic. Brad, what's up?
What I wanted to touch on, Ben, was obviously you've made that trip to the UK as well, and you've seen the difference in standards of the game. What did you try and implement to build the standards within that culture? Did you just try and work from the ground up with the like the lying roots of the game around the particular area, or did you just try and deal with like the large group you had that was at the top end and see if you could fix that?
Well, professionally, when I went over to the UK, I went to Leeds initially, and they were quite a successful club.
Yeah.
And so I just had to play my part there, and they trained quite intensively and very similar to the NRL. And then halfway through that year, I got a transfer to Wigan, and Michael Maguire was the coach there. So there wasn't too much difference between Melbourne Storm's intensity, and they were quite a successful club at the time as well. So that was quite easy. When I went to Widnes Vikings, they just got promoted from the championship level up to Super League. So they were virtually like a reserve grade side, New South Wales Cup side, coming up into a professional environment. Now, that was tough. The first year we got wooden spooners. I think we only won three games. It was always a struggle to bring that competitiveness at training and that professionalism into training every day. But it was pretty easy for me because that's just how I always trained and how I always went about my business, that I just had to do that inherently, and hopefully that would start to rub off. And I started to mentor a lot of the young forwards, and they, as a group, progressed the group more so than probably anyone. And then our second year, I think we just finished out, so the eight with a few recruitments. So we got better, but it was just trying to get that intensity level that a lot of these guys had never seen or been a part of before, and just really open up their eyes to, holy, this is a professional level now. You're in the Super League. I'm trying to bring this NRL training intensity to it. So that was a bit of a struggle. That was probably the biggest sort of challenge, but it was terrific being put in that situation. So I've been at the club at the top of its game with Wigan and Leeds and Melbourne Storm, but also been involved with the club right at the bottom. I mean, right at the bottom. You actually just promoted into Super League. So that was a good learning point, that just bringing that same professionalism and intensity, regardless of what level they were at.
Was there like an organisation with maybe the CEOs and the directors that put like a 5-year plan together and said, this is obviously where we might finish up in the first season, and this is what we want to?
Unfortunately, they just had an owner with a bit of money and a goal to own a rugby league team, and he threw a bit of money at it. And
a bit of a hobby.
Eventually, they went insolvent and they went broke.
And
a lot of people lost their jobs, unfortunately. Yeah, so
yeah.
It's just a little bit how they do things over there. They're not always in it for the right reasons. They're a lot of those wealthy owners are in it just so they can talk to their friends in their high up places and their parties that they own a rugby league team, unfortunately. But
yeah.
Some clubs don't like that, but unfortunately some are.
Yeah. All right. Cool. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All
right,
thanks, Brad. Any other questions for Ben, Jimmy, Joe, James, M? Any questions before we sign off?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Wade, we've got a question. You talk about the importance. I think this is for you, Ben. You talk about the importance of competition during training as a player and coach. What are some effective methods you use or tactics used on you as a player?
Just try to make your small-sided games or any games that you have competitive, like they have a consequence. That's sort of really anything. If, let's say, for instance, you want to do a sprinting drill, you make it a chasing sprinting drill.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get caught, you lose. You've got to do something for the teammate, or you've got to do something for the other athlete. There's numerous ways of making things competitive. Just bragging rights sometimes is the best sort of thing. So it carries over to the next time they're going to do it. Making just small little consequences for all little games that you can. It would be a small sort of game with a 3v2, or it's a edge v edge, or it's a soccer game with scored goals, or even tennis matches where you play to first to 5 points or something like that. Just find ways to make it competitive.
You mentioned like on field and tactical and stuff. Was there anything in the gym that was competitive, like strength?
Oh yeah. Jesus, yeah. Like everyone wanted to be the strongest bench presser. Everyone wanted to be the biggest squat in relative to maybe your body weight, or you do it in pound to weight ratio, strength competitions and things like that, push-up competitions. When you put a bunch of guys, a lot of testosterone in the gym and there's competition, they'll start to sort it out themselves as well. You just got to dangle a few carrots and the players will take it over themselves.
Yeah, to set the scene. One of my favorite things is, and I learned this from a friend and a mentor, David Hodge, and we applied this a lot in tennis. Anyone who lost would have to shake hands with the person who beat them, look them in the eye and say, thank you for teaching me a valuable lesson.
Yes.
And that was just enough. Like there was no... Yeah.
It's demeaning, isn't it? It feels pretty demeaning. Yeah.
It was just, thank you for teaching me a valuable lesson. The person that you've just been wrestling with or playing tennis against or whatever. And that was enough. Like it didn't have to be a massive 10. It didn't even have to be $10. It was free. Yeah.
Now, after a while doing that, hopefully the athletes started to take the lessons away, not just the loss.
Yes.
So he actually did teach me a lesson. He got me in that stranglehold, or he got me with that little drop shot, or he got me with that little show and go. So they don't forget to take the lesson with them after the shaking the hand.
Yeah, 100%. Well, guys, I'm not seeing any other questions come through. We'll give it another.
Can I ask one more question? And sure, Brad. Both of you might have an answer for this, but just in regards to that, Ben, where you talked about your small-sided games and trying to make everything competitive, and I 100% agree. I think that's a really strong driver for motivation.
Yeah.
But then you get a lot of coaches that go down the path of, if they don't get the carrot that you're dangling, then there's a punishment at the end of it. I also see the benefit of that too, but perhaps not necessarily the physical punishment that old coaches might want to use. I just wanted to see what your thoughts was on that. And same with you, Grant, if you think someone doesn't perform, do they do 10 sets of Malcolms or whatever they could possibly do on a tennis court, what your thoughts are there?
All right, Ben, you go first.
We tried this once at Hunter Sports High and it was positive punishment. Now, we used to talk quite a bit about the fittest athletes and the fittest players get more game time. So it would be that the players that would hit the number, say, for instance, they had to do a 50-meter sprint in, say, 10 seconds or something like that, and they got it, they got to do another sprint.
Mm-hmm.
And the players that didn't get the sprint in the time didn't get to do it. So they would have to do a conditioning session or something after. They'd still have to do the work, but it wouldn't be then immediately. Or, you know what, we might not even get to them. So the work wasn't actually put into an athlete. I can't remember where it was spoken about, but you can talk about positive punishment. And so the players that were getting the times, they would have to keep on doing the runs.
Yep.
And they'd keep on doing it until they missed their times. So then the guys that would be always getting the times allocated, they're getting more conditioning putting into them. So we'd really sell and praise that to them. Oh, wow, that's terrific. The fittest players get to play the most minutes. So the guys that were dropping out early and not making them knew they weren't going to get a lot of minutes. And it was just a little couple of things that we tried to implement a couple of times within the school environment. And the kids loved it. They started to really see it as a reward. With, oh, I get this next 50 meter in 10 seconds, I get to get another one. That's means I'm getting fitter and stronger and faster.
Yeah.
It doesn't work in all realms, but there is a bit of science behind it and a study done it on positive punishments for conditioning effect. And you have to sell it to it, but you really have to sell it to your players that you really value fit, conditioned players for them to buy into it. Because you might do a beat test. We used to do beat tests with the Hana Sports High School as well, and kids would drop out real early. So they would be sitting on the sideline watching these kids go really hard at it, getting up to their 12s and 13s and 14s. But there'd be no punishment for that kid dropping out on a 9 or a 8. They'd just be done.
Mm.
But the guys that have really pushed themselves and really, yes, they might be fitter and better condition just naturally, or they've worked a little bit harder. So then that means those other kids, they probably have to do a little bit extra. That positive punishment or positive conditioning is something that I think there has got a bit of merit, but it can only be used in a certain aspects in an environment where you've really sort of built a lot of trust within it as well.
Yeah.
Brad, just to answer your question, I do not understand why any coach would use physical punishments, especially if it's an exercise that I'm going to use in the gym. So, for example, and tennis was a great one. When I started at the National Academy, the push-ups was the default. So if you lost or you did something bad or whatever, you did push-ups. But I wanted to do push-ups as part of the athletic development. And the tennis coaches were associating that exercise as a punishment. But if it was something that I didn't so I think what we ended up agreeing on is if they ever wanted to do something, it would be a wall sit. I've never programmed a wall sit. Uh-huh. I didn't mind them doing it, but I think there's so many better things that you can do, and you don't, it doesn't need to be physical. So Luke,
I totally just to back up that as well, that with physical punishment in sports, a lot of sports where if they drop a ball in rugby league, all of a sudden they've got to drop down and do 10 push-ups. Like, all the players getting better at is doing push-ups, not catching a ball. So why would another coach quickly go over to them, throw them 10 bad passes straight away so they can actually work on the issue that might have been?
Yeah.
So if a guy drops 5 balls in training, he's done 50 push-ups, he's got really good at doing push-ups, he hasn't got any better at catching passes.
Exactly. But I've got a question. Luke's taken his microphone off mute. So Luke, have you got a question?
Yeah, can you hear me there?
Yes.
Yeah, mate.
Yeah, I guess this is just going toward, obviously, more for Ben, but going across what you've just been talking about. Obviously, you've got the player background, yes and C, obviously, experience, and then obviously the coaching. I guess, where do you sit as a coach between or S and C standards for players in a group? So I guess give you a little bit of a scenario. You've got two players, you know, probably playing in your middles or a playmaker. One player, obviously, you know, hitting all your S&C standards, skin folds, weights, you know, pushing themselves, as you said, and getting rewarded for it. But I guess skill-wise, technically, tactically, not the best. But then you've got the other player who, you know, has great playmaking skills, has good leadership and organisation skills around the park. But in terms of S&C, doesn't necessarily push himself. So I guess, where do you sit in terms of that, and how would you approach that situation?
Well, I've seen that situation at a professional level as well, and sometimes you're going to have different athletes that are adapt to different levels as well. So some rugby league players, we'll just use rugby league. Rugby league, some are just better athletes, as in they can run faster, lift more. And then there's other rugby league players that are actually just better rugby league players. So they're not the essence. They won't fit into the pigeonhole of the box as a an athlete per se, and they mightn't hit all their benchmarks and their markers in their numbers. But if they can do what's good enough to get them at a level to be consistent with their performance to an acceptable level decided amongst the coaches group, and he's not missing his markers on his performance, well, then that's something that sometimes has to be altered in your view of the player, where the lesser skilled player needs more physical development and hits all those markers because he relies on more of his athletic ability to keep his spot in the team, where this other player relies more on his rugby league ability to keep himself in his team. Now, if his rugby league performances start to dwindle because he physically can't keep up to the speed of the game, he can't play 80 minutes, or he's physically not there, well, then you start to have an issue. But if he can do his role as a rugby league player without hitting all his benchmarks, well, then you've got to have some sort of compromise there, because ultimately, at the end of the day, at a sporting level, you're there to pick rugby league players to play a sport. You're not ultimately there to pick an athlete who is the best bench presser, the best squatter, has the best 10-back, 20-back time, or the best beep test time, and then he can't play footy as well. So, again, there's that fine line, like we were saying before, that where you sit. If their performance is at the acceptable level, well, then ultimately you've got to be looking at, is it required for your sport within the ticks of the box? I hope that sort of answers the question enough, that you're not going to get all your athletes hitting all their benchmarks. You're not going to get all the athletes doing what is 100% required of them. But in your given sport, if they're playing to the level that's acceptable, that's sort of set by you as a coach or the head coach or his position, well, then that might be what you're sort of basing him on.
And I think, Ben, that also ties back into sometimes the strength and conditioning coaches, we think in terms of maxes, like how heavy can you squat? But, you know, I'm thinking of a player that you played with, Cameron Smith. I'd be guessing that he's not the best in the gym, but it's instead of a maximum, he's strong enough. He's fast enough. He seems pretty fit, but it's more of a threshold. If he was below that, then he couldn't play his 80 minutes.
Yeah.
And he's got enough of that. So then, hey, let's go work on more decision-making, kicking, catching, passing, whatever the other skills are.
And that's a really good word, enough. Enough to do his role confidently on the field. And you take a player like Cameron Smith and he wins nothing. Wins no 1.2Ks run, wins no 400s, win no bench press, no squats, no...
Might win commentary.
Yeah, that would be about it. On the field as well. Wins nothing in the gym. Wouldn't win a single thing in the physical aspect of rugby league. Put him on the football field, he'll
pick him every time.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Guys, thank you for that.
Thanks, Luke. Okay. Thanks, bro. Thanks, everyone, for, and especially thanks, Ben, for.
No, thank you.
Coming on. We will be recording this, and if you want to share this, or if you've got some people that might be interested on Propel Perform, check on there. And we've got a bunch of these coming up. So, Ben, thank you very much for your time and your knowledge and your sharing your experience. And we'll see you guys another time.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for tuning in, guys.
Cheers, Ben. Cheers, Grant.
All right. Thank you.
See you guys.